Welcome to Leading Lines, a podcast from Vanderbilt University. I'm your host, Derek Brough, Director of the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. In this episode, I speak with Tim Foster, a graduate student here in Vanderbilt's Department of Spanish and Portuguese. Tim is an active member of the digital humanities community here, and he has worked at the Center for Teaching, the Center for Second Language Studies, and the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning. Tim uses technology in his teaching in creative, intentional, and effective ways, and I'm excited to share some of his work here on the podcast. Last fall, Tim was on a panel that my center co-organized with Vanderbilt's new Center for Digital Humanities. The panel focused on teaching with Wikipedia, and I was impressed with the class project Tim shared, in which he worked with his students to write for the Portuguese language version of Wikipedia. Tim and I sat down to talk last December, shortly after that panel. Well, thanks for talking with me today, Tim. I'm looking forward to chatting a little bit about your teaching experience.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Ways you've used technology. Let's start with a little bit of context. Tell us kind of who you are and what you do here at Vanderbilt and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a fifth-year graduate student in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese. So I'm finishing my dissertation on the job market now. I have taught for 3 years in the department. We teach as instructors of record the kind of elementary to intermediate language courses. And so I taught 6 semesters of that. I also taught, I was a course assistant on a Maymester trip, walking the Camino de Santiago, or the Way of St. James pilgrimage in Spain. Let's see, I also taught a course at the Vanderbilt Program for Talented Youth at Peabody, which was a really great teaching experience. And then...
Was that a summer course?
Yeah, summer course. Week-long course. I taught about Spanish conquistadors to 4th and 5th graders. It was a really great experience. Honestly, one of the hardest things I've ever done, but something that really helped give me teaching experience as a graduate student, really substantive teaching experience, and also helped me rethink my own research agendas in ways I never expected, because to present something to 3rd and 4th graders really forces you to think and make choices about where you're going with your own with your own research and teaching. But that's kind of neither here nor there.
That's neat though. Well, you mentioned your research agenda. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm writing a dissertation about, I'm an early modernist, so I study 16th and 17th century Spain, and I'm writing a dissertation about the representation of music and how it gets framed through the lens of empire in the Spanish Empire. And it's always an interesting thing, since we're thinking about digital educational technology, the way that my dissertation works, it would have been a lot harder 15 years ago, because digitization is at such a high level that all these texts that I consult, I would have had to travel to various libraries throughout Spain and who knows where else. But now they're all facsimile scans on the National Library of Spain or other websites, and it's incredible the amount of those old texts that we have because of the digitization efforts. That really enhances our research.
Well, I want to maybe come back to that in a minute as we think about how that kind of carries over into your teaching. But I know that you said a lot of your teaching here at Vanderbilt has been in language courses.
Yes.
And so can you tell us a little bit about some of those courses and some of the experiments in digital pedagogy that you've tried?
Absolutely. We have the strange distinction in the foreign languages of what we research and what we teach is in some ways distinct. We're researching literature, but we teach the language. And so we're always trying to find ways to bring literature and bring cultural material into the language classroom to really give a contextualized and culture-centered language education. And so what we do is we're mostly given the syllabus by our department, but a lot of the day-to-day activities we get to determine. The interesting thing about foreign language pedagogy is that there's this concept from, I don't know, 30 years ago called computer-assisted language learning, CALL, And okay. it's kind of one of those buzzwords, you know, that gets thrown around like, oh, I'm proficient in call. But we had this interesting discussion a few years ago that computer-assisted language learning is basically just language learning now because it's so ubiquitous and is so transformed the way that you're able to bring authentic cultural material into the classroom. Mm-hmm. Whereas before the profusion of the internet, maybe what you have are some books that you gathered during your travels abroad, or even, mm-hmm. you know, just kind of little pamphlets or brochures or like maps. Those things are really kind of the ephemera of any day-to-day life, but that's where language is spoken. Mm-hmm. And so before the internet, maybe you only have stuff that you're able to gather personally, or the kind of scripted things that they put in textbooks,
sure.
Which give a good approximation sometimes of real cultural material. But it's no substitute for what we're able to do now, which, for example, if we're talking about like clothing, you know, we're wanting to learn sizes and colors and talking about how to buy clothing in a store. What I'll do is just kind of set my students loose on one of the major department stores websites in Spain, okay. for example,
yeah.
and
yeah.
say, you know, buy this, and give them a little guidance of, you know, maybe they would write a couple sentences about what they want to buy, or just kind of give them some framework to
sure.
Or some questions to answer, something, and just let them loose on the authentic material. And that's what that's a real advantage that we have as language mm-hmm. teachers, that mm-hmm. we have the whole internet
right.
of cultural
right.
cultural
right.
realia to available to us.
So you were on a panel
yes.
here a few mm-hmm. weeks ago on teaching with Wikipedia.
That's right.
Which is a very different use of online resources. Can
Absolutely.
You say a little bit about what that experiment was and kind of where it came from, which I thought was really fascinating?
Yeah. So Wikipedia, I have always found very useful in my own language learning and cultural research, because what I said in my presentation is that Wikipedia is kind of like the Goldilocks of resources that where you're looking at material in two different languages. So you have kind of three distinct types of dictionaries, to call them that way. You have the word reference or your Oxford Spanish-English dictionary, which gives you, you know, a couple of definitions of variance between from one term from Spanish to English, for example. Or you have the you know, the Oxford English Dictionary or the Spanish equivalent, which would be the Royal Academy Dictionary, which gives you 15 terms, five of which are archaic and are only used in my period.
Right.
And it's overkill for students, especially beginning students. And so, but neither of them does terms very well, and neither of them does cultural concepts very well.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to look up the United Nations organization, for example, you're going to find it's going to literally translate United Nations organization, or it'll give you a definition of what it does, but it doesn't, that's no help in how do you say United Nations organization in Spanish?
Right.
Because
there's
a particular name for it. And
sure.
so what I always do in those situations is go to the Wikipedia page, and then you, on the left-hand side, it has all those different languages that the,
sure.
the article is in different
yeah.
languages, and change the language. And there you have it. It gives you the name and all the cultural information. The example of this that I gave in class was that a student asked me, how do you say ice bucket challenge in Spanish? This was
okay.
back in, I think, 2014 when that was a big thing.
Right. There were all these viral videos
exactly.
on Facebook of people pouring ice on themselves.
Yeah, for
some good cause.
ALS, I think.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't know, you know, I could translate ice and bucket and challenge, but it would be some kind of garbledygook. And so I just went to I did exactly what I was saying, went to the Wikipedia page, and, you know, switched it to Spanish. And my student asked, is that a good translation? And I said, it's not a translation. In that moment, it kind of dawned on me that for the student, they had assumed that all cultural production was in English and that everything not in English was a translation.
Hmm. That the Spanish language Wikipedia page for Ice Bucket Challenge
right.
it, was merely a translation of the
be.
English language
exactly.
page
right.
for that topic.
Exactly.
Okay. But
yeah.
that's not how Wikipedia works, right?
No, exactly. It's all independent content written in the language. You know, perhaps Ice Bucket Challenge is something that originates in American English, but there are also communities of all language speakers in the United States that talk about the Ice Bucket Challenge in their own language.
Sure.
And, you know, so that's a cultural concept born in English, but, you know, it also has original content in other languages. You know, that's not even considering whole concepts that are born in foreign languages and translated into English.
Sure. Yeah.
But I think that when we have a monolingual approach in our society, that we encourage thought patterns that suggest that all content is born in English and then translated outwards. And so I got to thinking about that understanding of my students. And a couple of semesters ago, the spring of 15, I got to sort of be the coordinator of my own Portuguese course. I was the only teacher of the intensive elementary Portuguese section that semester, which rarely ever happens, and was really such a great good fortune on my part that I was able to design the syllabus for that class, not really design the syllabus, but design all the principal activities,
sure.
the assessments.
Yeah, yeah, you didn't have to link up with other sections of the same course. You
exactly.
could kind of run your own show.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is, it sounds like a bit of a gift for a grad student in your program.
It really was. You know, I think there are other disciplines in which graduate students get to design their own syllabi, but there are
it's
a lot of disciplines.
It's pretty rare, actually, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
English and philosophy are the other
right.
two that I know of on our campus.
But a lot of graduate students are TAs in the sense that they are assisting
sure.
faculty members. And we're considered TAs, I suppose, although we are the instructors of record in our
yeah.
classes. We give the grades. And so it was a great opportunity for me to implement this activity that I wanted to do. In fact, I didn't even think of it until halfway through the semester, which is why, like you said, I didn't have to link it up with somebody else's syllabus.
Sure.
I was able to, on the fly, make this change where I substituted the final composition for the Portuguese class. Usually it's like a 1.5 or 2-page essay for a Wikipedia assignment
mm-hmm.
where I had each student write a section of a Wikipedia page. I contemplated at first having them write their own page, but I thought that would be too laborious and kind of distract from the point of the exercise,
mm-hmm.
which was to both think about these kind of real world applications of their language and also to think through my particular pet issue of having students think that English is the only place where content can be born.
Yeah.
So what we did was first we had to look a little bit at what Wikipedia is.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the students had used it before but
sure.
didn't have a good idea of how the content was really generated, what are some of the identity politics issues behind the production of Wikipedia. You know, there's a very high percentage of the content that's produced by young white males in English-speaking contexts,
mm-hmm.
and you know, we couldn't really do a lot to change those statistics in my particular case because we're Americans, and a lot of my students were white, and a lot of my students were males. But even so, thinking through that, I think is really
sure.
important in any context when you're
well,
dealing
and I think
with
especially
Wikipedia.
For Wikipedia because it's, and I think one of the reasons that academics are a little bit queasy about Wikipedia is that like there's no sense of authorship.
Right.
Right? Like, you
yeah.
contribute content, and then it's this entry, and yes, it's possible to find out who put in which sentence
mm-hmm.
and which phrase,
mm-hmm.
but that's not, that doesn't make that very clear or very obvious.
Exactly. It's anathema to all of the structures of authority that we've been creating
right,
over centuries.
Right, right, right. The you know, the people's authorial voices, our citation
mm-hmm.
systems, right? It's just a very different way of doing things.
Right.
So I think, particularly with students, who may also kind of think of Wikipedia as somehow authorless.
Yeah.
Right? I think it's helpful to pull back the curtain a little bit.
That's
so
right.
they can kind of
yeah.
see actually how it gets made and what that might how that might show up in what you see there.
Absolutely, and how it might influence how they write. Because a large portion of thinking through Wikipedia too is the authorial tone, not authorial tone, but the neutral tone.
Right.
Because you know it's not an argument. It's not. It's not an argument. It's a more of a summation of knowledge mm-hmm. about a particular topic, and so. Our first step was looking through what Wikipedia is, and then we had to decide on an article. So I wanted an article in Portuguese Wikipedia about something that the students could really contribute knowledge to, mm-hmm. But that was not covered well. And so I looked at a couple pages like the American South, Vanderbilt University, for example. And what my students decided that they wanted to do was the page on Nashville, the city.
Oh, yeah.
It was about a paragraph long, maybe two, just basic information, no tables, no graphics, nothing.
Okay.
And so...
And I can imagine the English language Nashville page is probably pages and pages of history and information
right,
and culture.
Right, with 50 citations plus and different sections on everything, exactly.
So this was an underdeveloped part of the Portuguese Wikipedia.
Right, exactly. Okay. Probably understandably so. Although, you know, Portuguese Wikipedia has large pages on many major American cities. Mm-hmm. Some of the biggest cities known to Brazilians are New York and Orlando, for example, and they have huge pages.
Sure.
My students, I had them each decide on a section of the page that interested them. So one did about demographics, one did about sports, one did about tourism, one did about healthcare, etc.
Yeah.
Had 12 different students, so 12 different sections. And I had them, we layered it in, actually I only did it in about 5 weeks, which was crazy for everybody. But that first week I had them bring in at least three citations that they were going to use, kind of a little outline of the of their article. And then the next week I had them write the section. It was, I think, 450 to 500 words in a word processor. So just deal with the language part.
Sure.
So that was kind of the baseline of that's what they would have been doing with the other essay.
Sure.
So, you know, the other essays...
Composing in Portuguese.
Exactly, yeah. Right, which is ultimately the point of the class. You know... Typically, a prompt in a beginning language class is something like write a fake blog post about yourself and your daily routine and where you go to school and who your friends are, and that's interesting. And it helps them use the language at a level that they can really write something that they know. Mm-hmm. But it's not robust. It's not making any kind of argument. And there's also something we talk about a lot in language learning. That it's too me-centered. That a lot of the time when you're talking, doing like verbal practice in a language class, it's all about me.
Right.
You're saying I go to the store. I eat apples.
Right.
You know, I like eating.
I have two aunts and an uncle. And,
exactly.
Right.
Which is fine. You need to be able to talk about yourself.
Right,
but
right.
I think it only furthers this kind of English-centered approach I'm familiar with is what is important.
Sure.
And so. That's another, I think, a really big advantage to doing this, not only having the sources cited, but writing in this more neutral Wikipedia tone, is that you get out of the me-centered language production.
They can still write about something they know or are learning to know, as they're kind of mostly new to Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a topic of interest to them.
Yeah.
But it's not themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. So I had them do some peer editing on their little section, then I did a lot of editing to make sure that their grammar was as flawless as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when they had the finished language piece, then we did some coding basics in the class, in class, and it took like 30 minutes one day. And this class met four times a week, so we had a little bit of time to do some of the training. I did find that the students struggled with it a little bit more than I thought. And that goes back to a lot of the discussions around our quote-unquote digital natives. But really, we can't assume too much. You know, in the end, coding is a different... it's a different thought process. I think it was a lot to expect of them in a week and a half's time.
I'm gonna play my computer science major card here. Like, I wouldn't call markup language coding either.
Right?
I mean, you're not kind of programming it to do things. You're formatting using kind of text markup, which, again, there's a learning curve there. But, I mean, I don't do that very often, right? And I know how to use markup languages, right? When I have to actually code something in HTML, it's usually because something has broken and I have to go and fix it the right way. To think that, you know, students would know that or be familiar with that, that's just not how they typically use technology.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
I wonder if also it might also circle back to what you said about who contributes to Wikipedia, right? Mm-hmm. Because if students start to have a better understanding of what it requires technically to contribute, that might help them give a little more sense of, well, you know, who are the people who are going to have those skills or that aptitude?
Right. Or who have been taught that they have that aptitude, or who have the accessibility to the internet for long enough to develop that aptitude.
Yeah,
and Wikipedia does a nice job of providing tutorials.
Sure.
So they have a kind of general tutorial that explains Wikipedia and its and how to use it, but they have specific ones for students. They have specific ones for educators of some of the things to keep in mind when you are bringing Wikipedia into the classroom. They have a special set for particular higher ed professionals.
Okay. Yeah.
And they have a series of case studies. It's all done through the Wikimedia Foundation.
Okay.
They have a series of case studies of how different faculty members have used Wikipedia in the classroom on a wide variety of subjects for different purposes. You know, one that really stuck out to me was in an art history class, they had students add images to Wikipedia pages. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't even writing content, but it was providing some of that more image support. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of really interesting ways that people are using Wikipedia.
Yeah. So your students collaboratively helped to flesh out the Nashville page, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of curious, because I mean, you could have had them just kind of write essays and turn that in.
Right.
Right? But they were writing about a particular topic, you know, for a particular website. You could have also had them all just write a little guidebook to Nashville in Portuguese that they never that you put on your own website,
right,
or that they never shared online. What do you see as the advantages of going kind of full Wikipedia and having them go there to do this kind of writing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's something kind of basic in the knowing that what you produce is going to be out there for people to see, that I think makes you really heighten your own sense of the value of it and heighten your own the work that you put into it. I was floored by the amount of work that my students did for this, not only the good writing that they did and the mm-hmm. references that they brought in. I you know, had the three references as a baseline, but a lot of them brought in 10 or more references, which is amazing. They just went above and beyond. Mm-hmm. They, you know, had to learn the code, the markup, I should say. That's a good distinction between coding and markup. Then on the day where we put it all together, those who had finished everything and it was really clean, I asked them if they wanted to mark up the climate tables and the like the sister cities, which all required some a little bit more advanced marking up. Uh-huh. And they just ran with it, those who had the aptitude and the time. So that was really great. And I found, like, that kind of thing where your assignment is done and you're all sitting there all together in class with your laptops open. What am I going to do? Am I going to surf the web, or am I going to help my class and contribute to this awesome project that
and
we're doing together?
Make it even better.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing. I don't think that I would have seen that extra effort had this been something that just got turned into me.
Sure.
Because, you know, I think students want their work to be impactful, and not that a professor reading it is not a wonderful exercise.
Right, but it's an audience of one,
exactly.
Right? And then no one ever sees it again.
Mm-hmm. So I found that there was a buy-in from the students that I don't think that there would have been otherwise. And that was really the advantage of doing something, going full Wikipedia, as you said.
Yeah.
And it was really going full Wikipedia. I wanted the students all did have to create their own Wikipedia account. So that they could play in the sandbox. They have what they call the sandbox,
okay,
where you can kind of test the coding that you, or the markup that you have done, and make sure that it all plays out okay, make sure that there's no kind of errors. And so they all had to sign up for their own accounts on Portuguese Wikipedia. You have to sign up for different accounts on different Wikipedias,
okay,
which was fun. And I wanted the students originally to make the edits themselves on the Wikipedia page and put in their new section. But what I found was that when I went in and created the skeleton for what our new page was going to look like, I tried to upload that change, and I got a nasty note from a Portuguese Wikipedia administrator that said, the real page editing is not the sandbox. Don't put titles with empty content in them.
Oh,
it was like 20 seconds after I had made the change.
Wow.
You know, I was going to have the students do it, you know, 5 minutes after that, because we were in the class. And so I said, okay, well, I guess everybody, you can just send your code to me and I'll upload it all together.
All at once.
Yeah.
So, finished product. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But I thought that was a really good, kind of, I don't know, lesson or something that we all were learning together.
Sure.
And the students thought it was really funny, because they got to see their professor, get
scolded.
Get scolded
right.
By Portuguese Wikipedia administrators
in real time.
In real time, yeah. And they were all like, they were all reading it and like, oh, that's a command. You know, that's really he got you good.
Right.
You
know? So they were using the skills they had learned.
Yeah.
To,
it was a lot of fun.
Enjoy your scolding.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Happy to have been the butt of that. Yeah.
Right. But again, I mean, and this is what I liked about these types of projects is, there's this term that's used in different ways in the literature, but I would say what you've done is you've turned your class kind of from a class into a learning community,
mm-hmm,
in that the students are all there learning together with each other, with you, learning from each other.
Absolutely.
Right? And it's not just this kind of one-way dump of information and skill development, but they're kind of building something together that they're kind of proud of at the,
mm-hmm,
end of it.
Yeah, they absolutely were proud. And I think on that point, the next time I do this, I will build in more peer review. We did kind of one very cursory round of peer review on the language side, and I think kind of a half of a peer review round on the coding, the markup.
Sure.
We just didn't have time because I didn't think of this until halfway through the semester.
Yeah.
I think the next time I'll really start this earlier. And actually, what I want to start with first is doing a translation. I hate to say this, but doing a translation of something, a cultural concept on foreign language Wikipedia that just isn't there in English. So, you know, there's a ton of
a
ton of random regional food products or whatever,
sure,
that have that just have no analog, they have no presence at all on English Wikipedia. And so I would love to have students take, you know, a paragraph or two, a little article, and translate that and submit a new article,
sure,
in English as kind of a first step to this. Understanding that not all production on Wikipedia is a translation, I would have to put a huge asterisk on that. But that might be a nice stepping stone, because they would be doing it. The first Wikipedia article that they edit would be in their native language,
rather than in the
language that they're just learning.
I was just imagining. Right, you mentioned they had to sign up for accounts in the Portuguese, mm-hmm, Wikipedia, which is a process that's all in Portuguese, right?
Right,
so,
exactly.
Like that
yeah.
alone would be perhaps a little challenging.
You know, it takes you 3 hours to read the terms and conditions.
right.
If anybody reads those.
right. Well, we've talked a lot about this one particular application, which I think is just really fascinating, and kind of raises some interesting learning dynamics that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a step back and think a little bit more broadly. And you mentioned kind of next time. I'll ask you about, as you look ahead to your teaching career, are there either technologies you want to try out or kind of ways of using technology that you want to make a part of your teaching as you go forward?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. As I go forward, I anticipate teaching both language and literature culture classes. And so that kind of changes a little bit the way that you incorporate technology. But one thing I always love to play with is mapping. I've done some work with mapping before in a language course. Instead of doing a traditional oral exam presentation, we developed a little assignment where students would go into Google Earth and go into street view of a random Latin American city and narrate their journey. You know, first I went to this restaurant and ate this. Then I went to, you know, this plaza and saw this monument. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was really kind of fun. I had three students who had recently been to the Dominican Republic, and they weren't particularly strong students, but they gave the best presentation because they had been there, and they were telling about their actual trip, and it was amazing. So I thought that was a really powerful use of that technology,
but in the target language,
exactly. Yeah. So I'd love to build in more with mapping, not only on the language learning side, but also literature. You know, a lot of literature is spatial. There's a lot of spatial components, and we've done a lot of work with that at the Center for Second Language Studies, where I was a graduate affiliate for 3 years, about mapping novels and, you know, creating a digital map and putting passages that happened in a particular location on the map. I think it's a really a different way for students to interact with a text. Mm-hmm. But also, one project that I worked on and really wanted to implement was, we have this Maymester trip that goes on the pilgrimage, the Way of St. James in Spain. I had built my own digital map of some of these, what I call them, folk shrines, that as you're walking on the pilgrimage, you see people building a little shrine to a dead pilgrim, or building a shrine to the saint, for example. And so I photographed those and made a nice little map of it, and that's kind of where it stayed. Hmm. But in talking with the professor who runs that program, we really wanted to have the students do something similar, where they would record a video talking in Spanish about a particular location on the trail that was meaningful to them, or taking a video by a monument and describing some of its features that we had talked about in class, some of the, you know, architecture styles or whatever, or a location where something important in literature happened. Taking a video of that and then uploading that video and creating kind of a class record of these impactful moments or sites to each student, but doing it all together so that we would map out the route of the pilgrimage and also practice the language, which is always important. Even in upper level literature courses, practicing language is always fundamental. Also some cultural and literary knowledge. And it would be a nice product that the class would have. So we worked on that project for a little bit, but when the students got to Spain, this was the year after I had assisted with the course, when they got there, the internet connectivity was just too much of a disaster.
Yeah.
Each hostel or hotel maybe had Wi-Fi and it maybe worked, but not for long enough for them to get the videos uploaded. And we thought about having them do it when they got home, but it just wouldn't have been the same. So that was kind of a bummer, but something that I'm looking to incorporate into classes that I do in the future.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there is something about the kind of being in the field and being able to document and then build that collaborative product together.
Exactly.
You could have them do it when they get home, but it would be a different kind of activity there,
right?
I mean, it might be a more reflective or synthetic activity,
mm-hmm.
But it might not have the same type of kind of in the moment capturing of the experience.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to end with one more question. We ask this of all of our guests. We talk a lot about digital technology on this podcast. What's one of your favorite analog technologies?
I've been thinking a lot about this question. At the risk of sounding too, I don't know, cheesy or cute, I want to say the classroom. There is something about being in the classroom with you, where you have the social interactions before and after class and during class, and you have the ability to pair off, to do so much of that that group work, to sounding out things between partners, that's harder to do on internet platforms. I think they can be done well, and maybe with the profusion of virtual reality, we can get to a place where digital classrooms will be just as good as analog classrooms, and I'd love to see that day. Yeah. But I do love the classroom.
yeah. There's something about being in the same place at the same time.
Exactly.
Right. And even the walls themselves as saying, hey, we're all here for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We're not here to kind of wander in and out, but we're here for a time and a purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's pretty powerful.
Absolutely.
I'm a big fan. Well, Tim, this has been great. Thanks for chatting with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Tim Foster, a doctoral student in the Vanderbilt Department of Spanish and Portuguese. We're trying here on the Leading Lines podcast to include different kinds of voices from the world of educational technology. That includes graduate students like Tim and like Zoe LeBlanc, the history grad student who appeared in episode 8. When it comes to the future of educational technology, something we're trying to shape through this podcast, I like to see what our grad students are doing. They often have the freedom and the creativity to try new things in their teaching, and I'm often impressed with how savvy they are about educational technology. If you want to see what Tim's students wrote for the Nashville entry in the Portuguese language version of Wikipedia, just search for Nashville in Wikipedia, then switch your language. Or check out the show notes, where there's a direct link. We'll also include in the show notes a few resources for teaching with Wikipedia, including ones provided by the Wikimedia Foundation and the Wiki Education Foundation. You can find those show notes on our website, leadinglinespod.com. We welcome your comments and questions there, and on Twitter, where our handle is @leadinglinespod. You can subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or your other favorite podcast app. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, please leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. That helps other listeners find the show. Leading Lines is produced by the Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications, and the Associate Provost for Digital Learning. This episode, like all our other episodes, was edited by Rhett McDaniel, the Center for Teaching's educational technologist. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. I'm your host, Derek Bruff. Thanks for listening.